This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video. Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek, sometimes with a special interview like this. I'm your host, Chuck Tomasi, doing another solo special interview with a good family friend of mine, Bud Thacker. Bud worked at NASA in the glory years from the early 1960s to the late 1970s. I met with Bud a couple of years ago while on a family trip to Florida and suggested we talk about some great things he worked on and the people he worked for. We finally aligned our schedules, and here he is. Welcome to the show, Bud.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be a part of it.
It's an honor to have you. I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody that does or used to work at NASA.
Well, I spent many years there and enjoyed every moment of it, so I'm happy to talk about it every time I have an opportunity.
Now, tell the listener what your position was at NASA and when you were there. We'll get started.
Okay, I began with NASA in June of 1962 and retired in July of 1979. And the last few years I was there, I was the chief of the Delta Launch Operations Division at Kennedy Space Center. And I was in charge of all Delta launches, both at the Cape and at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And my contractor was McDonnell Douglas Corporation, who since have been bought out or replaced by the Boeing Company. The Boeing Company is currently launching Delta.
Tell the listener a little bit about the Delta rocket. How many? It's still in use today, correct?
The Delta is in use. It was originally a NASA launch vehicle in the expendable launch vehicle section of NASA. NASA has numerous sections, some covering aeronautics, the MAN program, and just plain space science. And then there is the expendable vehicle group that had a number of vehicles, Delta being one of them. Others were Atlas and Titan. The Delta is basically was the smallest of the launch vehicles originally. And it started in early 1960 and has evolved over the years and now is up in well over 300, I think around 320 launches.
Wow.
That Delta has had in that period of time. And it's continuing to evolve. And several years ago, NASA decided they wanted to get out of the expendable launch vehicle business.
Mm-hmm.
And they transferred Delta to the Air Force. So it was a NASA vehicle. It is now an Air Force vehicle.
Oh.
And it is also available to be launched by private industry. The Boeing Company now can go out and contract for putting payloads into space for corporations or foreign governments. So it's launched either as an Air Force control launch or as a commercial launch by the Boeing Company.
Now, what does a Vision Chief do? Can you give me a little overview of what your job entailed?
Okay. When I arrived at Cape Canaveral, my division consisted of approximately 50 engineers plus some administrative people and maintenance people. We managed the contract that was held by the McDonnell Douglas Corporation. McDonnell Douglas manufactured the Delta vehicle and then performed the launch services with engineers and technicians. NASA does not put hands on any of the hardware, but I was managing the McDonnell Douglas group at the Cape and at Vandenberg. And at the Cape, for example, we had about 500 people working for McDonnell Douglas when I arrived. So during the countdown and the launch, I would serve as the launch director and would bring together support from the Air Force, range safety people, the weather people, and other organizations that participate, providing data and safety and things of that nature. So I was kind of the focal point for NASA for the actual launch of a Delta. And that the Delta was actually managed as a production manager by Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. But Kennedy Space Center had the responsibility for the launches.
Okay.
And, of course, we also then worked with the spacecraft people, the people who were putting the satellite into orbit, to integrate their activities in the preparation of their vehicle with the launch vehicle, and so that everything hopefully would come together smoothly and everyone would be ready to launch at the same time. And, of course, we were launching, when I was active, we were launching 12 launches a year.
Wow.
That means that you have vehicles on all three of those launch pads almost all of the time, because it, from the time you were to launch a vehicle from a pad, it would take 8 weeks before you could launch the next vehicle from that pad, because you have to, after a launch, you have to repair any damage that may have been done because of the big rocket motors that shoot flame all over the place. And and then you build up the vehicle. You build up the hardware just like a model kit, where you put the pieces together, and then you go through a test program that makes sure that all of the systems work independently and then ultimately together. And then the final step, in about the last week of preparation, is that you put the spacecraft, which has been in a laboratory being checked out on its own, on top of the vehicle, and then ultimately after a few days we launch. And basically that kind of puts it in a nutshell.
That sounds expensive.
Well, my last experience cost-wise was in the late 70s, and we were actually typically launching an all-up program. That is, the cost of the launch vehicle, the services, and the spacecraft, with a total value at liftoff of around $150 to $160 million for each one. The Delta launch vehicle was being sold, basically. In fact, I may add that we were launching 12 a year, but probably 11 of that 12 would be either commercial satellites for communications or things such as that, or satellites that were being put up by foreign governments. We launched 3 or 4 for Japan. We launched for Spain, France, Italy, the European Space Agency, and any number of people. And they were paying NASA for a ride, so to speak, on the Delta vehicle. NASA was charging them $22 million for the ride on the Delta. And quite honestly, it was only costing NASA $17 million to launch a Delta, so NASA was actually making money on each Delta launch that they performed for a foreign government or a private industry.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and this is not NASA's desire to make money. What it was a political game. They were, at that period of time, trying to encourage and force all users, commercial and foreign government, to prepare their vehicle, their spacecraft, for launching on the space shuttle. And they were only going to charge them $15 million for a launch on space shuttle, and they were charging them $22 million for a launch on Delta. And they said, hey, you know, the shuttle sounds like a good deal. The unfortunate thing is, after the Challenger disaster,
yeah,
a decision was made that no more commercial satellites will be launched on the shuttle. So they pulled these people into this game of designing their spacecraft to go on the shuttle, and then basically the rug was pulled out from under them. So they've now had to go back to vehicles like Delta or Atlas or Titan in order to get their spacecraft launched.
Hi, this is Tom Dutchick from Immersion Presents. You're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Now, I think I saw a news article recently that the Titan is being put out to pasture. They're destroying the last of the Titan engines and things.
Right. Titan was a very specialized vehicle that, because of its size, was attractive to be used for space launches. It was a rather large vehicle, and of course it was designed for carrying multiple nuclear warheads and was a little larger than some of the other vehicles. Although it was large, it was a very, in some ways, dangerous vehicle to use, because instead of using like kerosene and liquid oxygen like Delta and Atlas used, it used some very volatile propellants that were, for example, nitrogen tetroxide and unsymmetrical dimethyl hydrazine. These propellants, when mixed, will burst into flames or explode without any outside spark or any initiating force, which was beautiful if you had a vehicle sitting in a silo and you wanted to be able to light the match or fuse at a moment's notice, because all you had to do was open the valves, and when the propellants moved into the combustion chamber, they lit and you were gone. On Atlas, or the old Thor that the Delta was based on, if you were using liquid oxygen, which you couldn't load that on the vehicle and let it sit there because it would constantly boil off, so that was a last-minute thing. You would put the liquid oxygen on just before you launched, and that process took a considerable amount of time. So Titan was ideal for a weapon. It had a lot of lifting power for space work,
mm-hmm,
but it was somewhat dangerous, and it has now been superseded by an advanced Atlas that will carry even larger payloads, and a new version of Delta called Delta IV, which will use liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, just as the space shuttle does, and will have great lifting power with a lot more safety and reliability. So the Titan served its purpose, but it's been superseded now by advanced technology and equipment.
Well, I think that it's important to note that it is an evolutionary thing. The Delta you were working on in the 60s and 70s is not the same one they're launching today. I mean, it's like comparing the Ford Mustang from then and now.
Well, maybe even the Model T, because the original Delta that we launched was a combination of a Thor intermediate-range ballistic missile and an upper stage from the Vanguard program that was the Naval Research Laboratory's early attempts to put a satellite into orbit around the Earth, and they met with one failure after another. I think they finally succeeded to launch one Vanguard satellite, and it was about the size of a large grapefruit, and it weighed a few pounds, but it was, you know, a tremendous effort to get it up there. Well, the lower stage of the Vanguard was where most of the problems were. The upper stages, two upper stages, were pretty good. So the Delta program took the Thor intermediate range ballistic missile and put the two upper stages of Vanguard on top and called it Delta. And that was the start of a program that one of the first launches was a massive balloon that was like 100, 100 feet or 160 feet, I can't remember, in diameter. It was called Echo, and it was just a big reflective surface that was the first attempt at using space for communications. The signal, a radio signal, was bounced off of this big mirror and back to the other side of the country. And that was kind of a major step or milestone in the use of space for practical purposes. And, of course, now most of our communications go through satellites. And so it's really evolved a lot there. And the Delta went from that early beginning to larger stages. We ended up using 9 solid rocket motors clustered around the base of the first stage. And the Delta was an interesting program in that throughout its history, from that very beginning, it made use of hardware that was developed at great expense by other programs and modified it slightly and incorporated it, this hardware, into Delta to make a very inexpensive launch vehicle that was quite reliable. When I was working, our Delta at that time had a first stage engine that had been developed for the Apollo program.
Oh, no
kidding. Saturn 1B vehicle had 8 of these engines, and they were higher performance and higher output than the engine we'd been using. The Apollo program ended, and they had a surplus. They had all these engines sitting around, and so we said, hey, let's take that engine, modify the mounting hardware for it a little bit, and put it on our Delta. Well, we got about a 20 or 25% increase in thrust and a little more efficiency because it was a later engine. And then in this country had a project called Skylab that was an orbiting laboratory around the Earth, and it was put together with a special structure that was made from computer milling aluminum in a grid pattern that gave it extreme strength with very light weight. So we took that technology and used that to make our tanks for the first stage of Delta. The second stage of Delta, which was an engine that used the nitrogen tetroxide and unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine that Titan used, the Apollo lander, the lunar lander, had an engine that used those propellants. And again, when they developed the Apollo program, they had a surplus of hardware there. They made far more than they needed. So we started using that engine on our Delta vehicle. So our second stage engine was from the lunar lander, the one that allowed the vehicle to land on the surface. In the Apollo program, it was a throttleable engine. In other words, it had a throttle, much like you have on a car or an airplane, and you could vary the thrust. And, of course, that was necessary to allow a soft landing on the surface of the moon. For our program, we didn't need that, so we took out the variable throttling device and just put in a fixed throttle, fixed injector. And that way we saved a little money and gave us a little more reliability. And so that engine was used in Delta for many, many years. The upper stage, third stage, which was often used for Delta launches, was the solid rocket motor that was used on the Surveyor program that was one of the early vehicles that explored the moon before Apollo went there.
This is Steve Wozniak. You're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
So, you know, we just took bits and pieces. Oh, and a little further. The guidance system on our Delta was an inertial guidance system that used components from the lunar lander that had, you know, was part of the Apollo program. So,
wow.
There's hardly anything in Delta that was not secondhand, so to speak. We took parts from anybody and everybody. Oh, and by the way, our strap-on solid rocket motors had been Army short-range missile motors. And so, you know, it would be hard to find something on Delta that was developed only for Delta.
It's a rummage sale rocket.
Exactly, exactly. And it proved to be very inexpensive by comparison to other vehicles and very reliable. So, you know, that it's had a very good record over the years.
I never would have thought of that, because you always hear the stereotypical stories of the $5,000 hammer and this kind of thing. And it's nice to hear a lot of this stuff was reused.
That's right. We used the $1.98 hammer. No, but it was a very enjoyable working program or career, because you know, you really felt that you were accomplishing a lot with very little. And although the taxpayers weren't aware of it, we were probably saving them huge amounts of money compared to accomplishing what we did by some other means.
But it's still, at the heart of it, it was a business. So any savings you can make on the materials and acquisition and research and development side is just something you can pass on to the customer.
That's basically, although, like I said, NASA wasn't passing it on to the customer. They were they were actually, I don't think there's probably a government agency in existence that has ever made a profit, but under the cover of the political atmosphere at the time, NASA was actually making money on the Delta.
I have one final question.
Yes.
Did you ever get a chance to meet Wernher von Braun?
Yes, I did. Yeah, in fact, I worked for him. When I first went to work for NASA, my boss was Wernher von Braun, with an intermediate boss of Kurt Debus, Dr. Debus, who was at the head of all NASA activities at the Cape. When I first went to work for NASA, my organization was a part of the Marshall Space Flight Center, where Wernher von Braun was the head of the Marshall Space Flight Center. Kurt Debus, who was another of the German rocket scientists, was heading the launch end of that business. And the Cape, the NASA activities at the Cape, were originally a subsidiary of Marshall Space Flight Center. And then, of course, NASA underwent reorganizations, and that changed. But, yeah, I've met a lot of the old-time space people, in addition to Wernher von Braun and Debus. There were a bunch of other Germans who were involved, and they were all very sharp people. I've met John Glenn and Jim Lovell, who was the commander of Apollo 13, and Wally Schirra. I used to party with Wally Schirra at the Cape, or over at Cocoa Beach, and he's the only astronaut who flew in all three phases of the manned program in those days. He was in the Mercury program, and the Gemini, and the Apollo.
Wow.
And no other astronaut could make that claim. And so he was an interesting guy. And they were all interesting people. I enjoyed my working time tremendously, because it was, every day was a challenge. There was no routine. Every day you'd walk in the office, there was a new problem to deal with and a different kind of problem. And, you know, it was just, when you're launching from three launch pads, two on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, you're a busy person. And, you know, there's no time to ever sit around and think, I wonder what I should do next, because there's always something there to do next. And it was... It was a fascinating career.
Sounds like it. Bud, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's been terrific.
Okay, thank you very much. I was happy to do it. I don't get many opportunities to talk about my old days with NASA, because most people don't even want to hear it.
All right.
Okay.
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion with Bud. If you want to hear more interviews or check out our regular format for Technorama, go to chuckchat.com. If you want to get in contact with me, send email to chuck@chuckchat.com. Thanks for listening, and as always, a binary high five. 101.